Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And with me today, we have a special guest host, Paul Gandy, who's been a guest host with us previously, maybe, I don't know, half a dozen times over the years. Paul has a bachelor's degree from Harvard in African American Studies and a law degree from the University of Texas. And I thought he might be interested in our topic today. So, Paul, would you like to introduce our guest?
Absolutely. Thank you, Monica. Lon Stallworth is a law enforcement veteran and the first Black detective in the Colorado Springs Police Department. He has worked undercover narcotics, vice, criminal intelligence, and organized crime beats in four states. He's the author of the number one New York Times bestselling memoir, Black Klansman, which was released as the Oscar-winning film directed by Spike Lee, Black Klansman. Welcome, Lon.
And the book we're talking about today is his second memoir, The Gangs of Zion, A Black Cop's Crusade in Mormon Country. So, why did you decide, Ron, to write a second memoir?
Because life in Utah is interesting, especially for a Black man. There's a lot of, to sum it up, I like to tell people that I have a lot of people that I need to piss off. And I decided to tell the story of what I went through trying to get Utah to address the rising gang problem and the crack problem that was going on. And I went through a lot of political battles, brushed elbows with some of the political heavyweights in Utah society, including Orrin Hatch, the late Orrin Hatch, U.S. Senator. And I decided to tell the story as only I can tell it, because I'm the only one that was there from the very beginning.
Now, you went to Utah after Colorado, correct? So this was after the experiences that you wrote about in Black Klansman.
Yeah, I went from Colorado Springs to Phoenix, Arizona for 2 years, and then Cheyenne, Wyoming, Attorney General's office for 4 years before landing in Utah in 1986.
I have to wonder if it's, I hope it's okay to ask this, but why did you choose such white places to go to?
Because I was determined to be an undercover cop. Colorado Springs was not going to allow me to make that my career aspiration. And I said, going where I could go and where they will allow me to. And these are the places that offered me invitations.
As Monica was asking, Ron, you chose places where you in some ways were a bit of a unicorn. You could have chosen other places, larger, you know, urban areas or areas where there's larger Black population, but you chose otherwise. Is there any more you can give us context as to why you made those decisions?
Yeah, I applied to places like Cleveland, Ohio, places back east where there were large Black populations. That never entered in my equation. I'm not big on racial logistics. All I wanted to do was be an undercover cop. It didn't matter where I was. And I did apply to places that had a large Black population, and they didn't even bother to return my calls. Phoenix and Cheyenne, Wyoming did return my calls.
Wow. When you went to Utah, were you expecting to find gang activity there?
No, I was hired to be an undercover narcotics officer. And that was in 1986. The gangs, Crips and Bloods from South Central Los Angeles, and the Hispanic gangs from the East Barrio of L.A. Did not show up until roughly 88. And that's when we started dealing with gangs and crack cocaine.
And you had trouble getting people to believe that it was an issue, or to acknowledge, maybe not to believe, but to acknowledge that there was an issue.
No, it was a case of believing and acknowledging. They didn't want to accept the fact that what I was saying was true, for the simple reason that A, to use their argument, A, Utah was predominantly white population, B, Utah was predominantly Mormon population, and C, Utah was predominantly conservative. And in their frame of reference, those three elements made the fact that I was saying this about Utah not possible.
You wrote in your book, Ron, about how people are probably thinking, how in the world did gangs from LA end up in Utah? And you talked about the role Job Corps played in it. It's quite interesting. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
In Clearfield, Utah, which is about 30, 35 miles north of Salt Lake City, there is the fourth largest Job Corps facility in the country. And the Utah Job Corps facility in Clearfield was bringing in kids from South Central LA and the East Bayou of LA, Hispanic kids, for the purpose of filling their ranks. They get more money, more federal money based on the enrollment population. And so they were recruiting kids. Job Corps, don't get me wrong, is a good program. I support it. But these people were deliberately bringing in known street players and then denying to us as gang cops that they had such individuals on their facility. We would see them on the streets of downtown Ogden and downtown Salt Lake City on weekends when they would get their passes. We'd see them dressed up in their red and blue colors. We'd see them doing graffiti and catch them doing other stuff. And yet when we contacted Job Corps to get information about these kids, they always said they're not gang members. They may have been gang members in LA, but once they got here at the Job Corps, they stopped being gang members. I called them out on it several times. I challenged them several times to meet me in a public forum. You put your argument up, I put my argument up, and let's see which side the public chooses. They never took me up on that offer.
And you made a very interesting point in your book. You mentioned that Job Corps, and I would agree, I think Job Corps is a very valuable program. But in this instance, these Job Corps offices were managed by a private company. So they were actually, even though it was a federal government program, as I understand it, this company was making money off the program, and their profit, so to speak, came from the more people they had in the program, the more they were paid. And so they actually went out of their way to recruit students. Is that right?
That's true. The company in Utah was called MTC, Management and Training Corporation. And MTC got paid money. I don't know how much per student, but they got paid money for students that they brought in. And they were recruiting from LA, from Kansas City, from Chicago. We even had New York Job Corps kids. But the people they were bringing in were not good, quote unquote, Christians, to be put it that way. They were bringing in the bad element. And I had no problems with them bringing the people in. The problem I had is when we would confront them about the activities of these kids, they would deny that activity was going on because they were in Job Corps, and Job Corps did not bring gang members into Utah. They were lying, straight up lying, and I called them on it.
And the thing is, Ron, from reading your book, it isn't that you were out to get those kids. You actually wanted an opportunity to try and get them out of gang life.
I was trying to get kids out of gang life as much as I could. I wasn't after the kids. I wasn't after the people at Job Corps or MTC who were bringing them in. I simply wanted them to stop lying to us, tell the truth, work with us, and let's move on from there. They didn't want to do any of that. My job was threatened by the Job Corps director. He said, if you don't stop saying these things about us, you leave me no choice but to go after your job. I told him in several words, and don't ever talk to me like that again. I had various confrontations with people like that. The MTC director, after I testified at a congressional hearing, he came up to me afterwards and said, why did you have to say those things to the people in Congress? I said, what do you mean? He said, why did you have to tell them those things? I said, because it's true. He said, that's beside the point. Why did you have to say it? I said, because it's true. He said, well, we'll just see about that. And then he stormed off. And when I got back into town 2 days later, I got a phone call from the Commissioner of Public Safety, my boss, wanted to know why I said what I did in a congressional hearing. And I told him, because it's true.
Now, in your introduction, and I think this is an example of it, and I suspect we'll hear other examples, that for you, writing is the way, and the phrase you use, writing is the way to speak truth to power.
Very true. Very true. I retired as a sergeant from the Utah Department of Public Safety after 20 years of service. I was always told that if you would just play the game the way the bosses want to play, you could be the first black lieutenant in this department. And I said, the heck with being a black lieutenant. I am going to tell the truth, and they will deal with me on that basis and that basis alone. And if they can't deal with it, they know where they can go. So that's how I approached my job. I wasn't, I didn't do anything out of the ordinary. I just was very blatant about what I was doing and didn't try to hide the fact that we had some conflicts in terms of where they saw things and where I saw things. The only way that they could threaten me was to get me out of the job that I was doing. And I never worried about that because I had proven myself, I'll go so far as to say, I had proven myself to be a little bit invaluable to them because they didn't have anyone that had my base of knowledge and understanding who they could just slide right in and do the job. So the worst that they could do was put me in a uniform. And I made it very clear, if you put me in a uniform, being a highway patrolman, which I despise, I will be the worst highway patrolman you've ever encountered, and I'll be so disruptive, you'll want me back.
Now, how do you write, let's look at this book, The Gangs of Zion. How do you go about writing a book? Are you longhand, you sit down at a desk, and you have your inspiration, just write throughout the day or night, or is it back and forth, you do a little bit here and there? I'm just curious how you sit down and create something like, or write something like this book.
I wrote this book the same way I wrote my police reports, from about, roughly 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night until maybe 2 to 3 in the morning. I always wrote my reports after a drug buy or whatever. And I wrote this book in the same time frame when it was quiet. My boys were asleep. I had peace and quiet in my house. And I simply start at the beginning where I want the beginning to be and go until I feel I've got the story told the way I want it told and stop. In Black Klansman, it took me 9 months to write Black Klansman. I started in March of 2013 and finished in January of 2014. This book was written in the same way. I don't use an outline or anything. I don't believe in that. I've taken writing courses. I've always heard them say, prepare an outline of the direction where you want to go. I don't do that. I don't believe in it. I start at the beginning and stop when I have it all down.
You know, I found it interesting that when you were teaching police officers or people wanting to be police officers, that if they couldn't write, you didn't think they could be police officers. Because you
I had a kid who was very adamant that he didn't care about writing. He just wanted to be an undercover DEA cop, and the writing would take care of itself. He'd get somebody else to write his report for him. I said, it doesn't work that way. And he insisted that he could pull that off. So whenever we had writing assignments, I paid particular attention to him. Quite frankly, he failed my class.
No. And reading your book, I was trying to think in my mind, what style is this? It's not poetic. It's not with much flourish. And when you describe it you write as you would write a police report, that rang a bell in my head. Yeah, that's what it's like. It seems very straight line, very linear in the way you write. This is the way it is. The facts, ma'am.
One of the criticisms I got from Black Klansman, which I considered a highly priced criticism, was somebody wrote, it reads like a long police report because it was a long police report.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It happened the way I described it. The incidents were put in chronological order the way a police report would be. The language was used as I would write a police report. And that's how I write. I'm not poetic. I used to hate the English classes that we had where we had to create poetry. I despised that class. I don't like to rhyme things. I like reading some poetry, but I don't like to make it up on my own. I just go straight to the heart of the matter and and let it go from there.
I'm curious. That's how you write, and you described it well, and that's how I read it. Whom do you like to read?
A more appropriate question is, who or what don't I like to read?
Okay.
I'm the type of person that I will read 3 or 4, sometimes 5 books at a time. I read a book that captures my interest, and when I get bored with it, I put it down, pick up another one, and then I'll eventually get back around to it. Right now, I'm looking at Heroes Without a Country, about Jesse Owens and Joe Louis's relationship. I'm reading Al Roker, Don't Make Me Stop This Car. I'm reading Tupac Shakur, the biography of Tupac Shakur, the authorized biography. And I'm reading a couple of karate books. I was a karate student and teacher when I was growing up in El Paso. So I'm reading about 5 books right now.
Sounds like you like biographies a lot.
Love biographies. Biographies, autobiographies. I like true life experiences to see what people have gone through in life to achieve whatever their means to their end was. That's one of the reasons why I write the memoirs that I do.
Now, do you still live in Utah or did you go back to Texas?
I came back to El Paso, Texas, where I grew up, to marry a young lady that I went to high school with. In fact, we live a block away from the school that we went to.
That's such a charming story, you know, reconnect. You know, my mother, who is often my co-host here and who is now 89 years old, my father died and then her second husband died, she reconnected with an old high school beau and they were sweethearts for until he passed away. So, yeah, it's a very sweet story.
The funny part about this was that my wife, after we started developing a relationship, she told me how she had a crush on me as a sophomore in high school. We had the same English teacher. Fat Black Klansman is dedicated to him, Mr. Elroy Bodie. We had the same English teacher as sophomores, but in different class periods. And she told me that she had a crush on me, but I never knew it until 2010 when she revealed to me that she had a crush on me 40 years earlier.
Oh, we all want that. We all want that to happen.
Yeah, all things in time.
Yeah.
Yes, very true.
In the afterword, I'm jumping around here a bit. I hope you forgive me.
No problem.
Forgive me, Ron. In the afterword, I believe a friend of yours, Dr. William Smith, professor at University of Utah. I hope it's all right. I think he referred to you as a hip hop career cop. Is that a fair description?
Is that okay to say? No, hip hop cop.
Hip hop cop. Okay, hip hop cop. Is it all right to use that phrase?
Yeah.
Hip hop cop. And of course, a large part, well, I'm not going to say of course, for those who haven't read it, and you should, a large part of your book talks about the relationship between gangster rap and gangs. And the influence gangster rap and gangs, of course, had in Utah, but gangster rap being central to it. Can you tell us about how you came to discover that, why you believe they're related, and what your relationship is with gangster rap, what your relationship was with gangster rap during this period?
Well, I don't believe they're related. I know they're related. We had white Mormon kids who were adopting all the cultural traits of South Central LA black Crips and Bloods. Crips and Bloods were black. They weren't white back then. And these kids in Utah were adopting all the characteristic traits of that, including using the so-called N-word. I find that word offensive. It has historically been used to destroy us and keep us down as a people. I despise that word, and yet I have white kids calling each other that term. And I remember, and I tell the story in the book, I remember asking these kids one day, tell me what one is. They said, what do you mean? They said, you're using that word. What does it mean? And they gave me this blank stare. And then I said, let me educate you. So I gave them a brief trip through time about what the N-word meant and why it is so hated by us as a people. Their response to me was, well, you people say it to yourselves all the time. I said, yes, we do. I said, we shouldn't, but we do. I said, you know why we do? It's because we have this skin and we have our cultural history. We have a history that binds us to that word. We can get away with it. You never can. You shouldn't use it. Well, these kids were learning how to be gang members based on the lyrics in some gangster rap song. NWA F the Police is the classic example. First time I heard F the Police, I almost had an accident driving home on the interstate three times because I was laughing so hard I couldn't believe that something like this was out there in the public genre. But the third time I listened to it, I stopped laughing because I truly understood what was being said and why. They were describing their culture growing up in South Central LA. They were describing what it was like being a Crip or a Blood. They were describing what it was like being a Black person on the low socioeconomic scale. They were describing the politics of American society, especially as it relates to the Black human being. All this was being fleshed out in rhyme on a rap song. So the kids were learning how to be Crip and Blood gang members. They were learning how to do drive-by shootings. There were some gangster rap songs that described in vivid detail the mechanics of doing a drive-by shooting. So I was studying this stuff to make myself a better gang cop and to understand the kids that I was dealing with on a regular basis. And ultimately, I didn't call myself the hip-hop cop. I never have. Other people have referred to me as that. But I was also called the foremost law enforcement authority on the subject of correlating gangster rap music with street gang culture. And that was given to me, that title was given to me by the late president of the California Gang Investigators Association.
And just last year, you spoke before the Texas, I believe, Law Enforcement Association, at least that particular part of it associated with addressing concerns about gangs.
Yeah, the Texas Gang Investigators Association. I spoke to them in about almost 30 years ago, and they asked me to come back, talk about Black Klansmen, but also to talk a little bit about gangster rap music. I don't study gangster rap music like I used to, since I'm not on the street anymore, but I gave them a class and enlightened a lot of them. Many of them had heard about me from my reputation. They had never seen my presentation or heard it. And when I gave it to them, I was very honored at the end. They had a line of about 30 Texas cops waiting to meet and greet me and thank me for the work that I had done over the years and what I went through to get to where I was at and to educate them and help them. I was very touched by it. And I described that in the end of the book.
What okay? I have a question of ours. I'm wondering, what's the difference between gangster rap and hip hop?
Hip hop is a culture. Gangster rap is music of a particular culture. Hip hop is the culture of breakdancing, DJing at the parties, the rapper to keep the party mood going. That's mm-hmm. hip-hop culture. Gangster rap music describes a particular type of music related to hip-hop.
Mm-hmm. There's hip-hop, which is not as hardcore, quote-unquote, hardcore as gangster rap.
I'll give you an example. DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince were not hip-hop, or not gangster rappers.
Right.
They were hip-hoppers, they were rappers, but they were not of the gangster genre. MC Hammer was not a gangster rapper, although the first female mayor of Salt Lake City tried to tell me that two gang kids got killed because they were listening to an MC Hammer song and it was gangster music. And I told her, you're out of your freaking mind.
Yeah, I know a little bit about that. I wouldn't call MC Hammer a gangster. But NWA, yeah.
Wow. It's interesting, too, in the book you talk about some gangster music was actually trying to warn people away from the gangster lifestyle.
Yeah. In Texas, in August, when I was here in Texas, I rapped the lyrics to a song called You Want Some of This, D-I-S. And after I finished rapping, I said, how many of you think that's a gangster rap song? They all raised their hands. I said, it actually isn't. It is a song about staying out of gangs, because it goes, you want some of this, then you're a stupid MF-er. In other words, stay out of our lifestyle, because it's nothing that you want. Stay out of it. You don't want some of this. So I broke it all down to them. And when I did, they said, now we get what you're saying. Now we understand. So you have to listen to these songs. I've developed an ear for it. You have to listen to these songs and understand what they're saying to break it all down. But not all gangster rap is negative. Back in the early 90s, they were putting out songs that were showing respect for women. It's commonly known that in hip-hop, and especially in gangster hip-hop, the rappers talk about women in very negative terms. Snoop Doggy Dogg made a whole reputation and career on that. Well, there are songs that were coming out in the 90s in which they were reversing that trend. They were talking about women positively, and how the women were the backbone of the male, the black male community. It was a positive form of gangster rap.
Now, is Snoop Doggy Dogg the same guy who was at the Olympics this summer on NBC?
Unfortunately, yes.
It seems like he's done a complete turnaround in terms of his treatment of women.
He has, and Snoop Doggy Dogg, God bless him for the career that he's made up with himself and everything. But I am resentful of the fact that he has, the public has embraced him as an elder statesman in the hip hop community. Snoop still brags about his gang affiliations. He is a Crip, Long Beach Crip affiliate. But he has shown them a different side of him, and more power to him for that, but I don't like it. Because he's the one that gave us songs like Gin and Juice and It Ain't No Fun If the Homies Can't Have None. In other words, if the homies can't share a woman, you know. But his whole image has been rejuvenated.
Wow. You know, you talked about the Job Corps and the privatization of that one particular Job Corps and how that caused problems. Do you see issues with the privatization of prisons?
Interesting you ask that question, because the Management and Training Corporation that ran the Job Corps in Clearfield, Utah, is also one of the progenitors of the private prison industry in this country. They have, I don't know the exact number, but they have a number of private prisons around the country. So on the one hand, they're trying to educate and get kids out of that lifestyle. On the other hand, they're incarcerating them.
See? And they make money doing it.
Of course. It's a whole contradiction. I don't like Management and Training Corporation. Let me put it that way.
I don't think prison should be for profit. It just,
no.
There's just so much wrong with that.
I do too. You need the professionalism that comes with training, and a lot of the people in the private prison industry do not have that training, and therefore aren't technically as professional as those that do.
Right, and cutting costs,
yeah,
you know, yes, can go too far.
It's about profit.
Yeah.
It's about profit.
Right, the incentive is not to rehabilitate, is to incarcerate. And you have a private prison system.
And make money.
And make money. Yeah.
Tell us about your chapters have interesting names. And there's a couple I'd just like you to talk a little bit more about. Tell us about Jimmy Joe.
Jamajo.
Jamajo. Jamajo. Thank you. Jamajo.
Jamajo was a Venice shoreline crip that I met at a barbershop in Utah. I knew he was a crip the minute he walked in the door because he was dressed from head to toe in blue. And I'm not joking when I say that, head to toe in blue. And when I finished with my haircut, I approached him and I said, come talk to me. I said, tell me, where are you from? He said, why do you want to know that? I said, just tell me where you're from. He wouldn't do it. I said, you're from L.A. I could tell because I said, you're a Crip. He said, why do you say that? I said, look at how you're dressed. he looked at me and he said, oh, yeah. I said, what Crip set are you with? He said, Venice Shoreline. That is a Crip group on Venice Avenue.
Tell us what you mean by Crip set. You said you use the word term set, please.
A Crip set is there are over, God, I don't know how many Crip groups there are, but the Crips are not an organized gang like most people want to see the mafia. The FBI, when they got involved working gangs, the FBI always used the argument, cut the head off and the body will die. There is no head in the Crips. You have different Crip groups. They're called sets. And each Crip group, each Crip set is different than another Crip set. For instance, there may be a Crip, there's a Crip group called the Rollin' 30 Crips, the Rollin' 20 Crips, the Rollin' 60 Crips. All these Crip groups are different. There is no single person at the top that controls or leads all of them. And so Venice Shoreline is a Crip set. It's a Crip group. That's all it means. And Jamajo was a Venice Shoreline Crip. So I told him to meet me the next day at, there was a Kentucky Fried Chicken down the street. I said, meet me at the KFC and I'll buy you lunch. He said, why you want to talk to me? I said, just meet me and you get a free lunch out of it. So the next day I got there early and I saw him approach and he got out, started walking. He walked to the window facing the main street. He saw me, he nodded at me. And then he walked around to the other side, peeped in the window there, looked at me and looked around and smiled. I knew what he was doing. He was checking to see if there were surveillance units in there and if he was going to be pounced on and arrested. And I had told him, meet me, nothing's going to happen. I just want to talk to you. So he did. He finally came in. When he came in, he walked around the KFC and literally walked and stopped in front of most of the tables looking at the people eating. And then he walked over to me. I said, sit your butt down. He sat down and I said, are you satisfied that there's no cops in here but me? He said, yeah. I said, good. Now, go get you something to eat. Bring me the tab and we'll go from there. He sat down. We talked. And I made this promise to him. I said, I know you're selling dope. I can look at you and tell. I said, you have my word that I will not bust you for any dope that you may be selling. But if I see you selling it, I will bust you. But I'm not going to pull a search on you or anything like that. But I know you got it. I said, you got some on you right now. And he didn't deny it, but he didn't admit it either. So we sat there, we talked, and I said, the reason I want to talk to you is I want to make myself a better gang cop. And if I can learn about your world, where you come from, why you are the way you are, it'll make me a better cop dealing with the kids on the street here. I said, that's what I want from you. And all you have to do is meet me periodically, have lunch with me, talk to me, and correct me. And that's what we did for a while. Well, one day we were talking, and Jamajo looked at me and he said, I got something I want to say to you. And he started choking up. I said, what's the matter? He said, I never really knew my father. He said, but if I had to have a father, I would want him to be like you. And as he said this, tears came into his eyes. And I told him I appreciated that. It meant a lot to me. And he literally had tears coming down his eyes and telling me that he wished that I was his father. Now, let me fast forward to bring this story up to date. A week ago, Jamajo contacted me on Facebook. He's in LA. He's married. He has a kid. He has a son. And he calls me Pops. And he told his wife, he said, honey, come here. Come meet Pops. He said, I tell all my friends about you, and I tell them that you're my Pops. You're the Pops that I never had, that I always wanted. Now, this is a Crip. This was a hardcore Crip gang member who has accepted me as his quote-unquote adopted daddy. That just goes to show you, you can reach some of these kids if you approach them the right way.
That's
and
inspiring.
He and I have several conversations over the past week or two.
Wow. So as a gang cop, you weren't undercover as a gang cop. You were out in the open.
No, I was not. This was not an undercover investigation.
Yeah.
I know some publicity on my book has said that. And when I found out they were saying that, I asked them to stop saying it because it's not true. Just like Black Klansmen, they kept identifying me as the first black cop in Colorado Springs. That wasn't true either. And I told them to stop doing it. They wouldn't do it. So every time I got an opportunity, I called them liars to the press that I'm talking to. Tell the truth about me. The truth will set you free, and I can deal with the truth. Don't make stuff up.
Okay. So what it surprised me to kind of – I got the picture that as a gang cop, you – like I said, you weren't undercover. You were out in the open. The gang members knew who you were. You knew who they were. And it was almost – it's almost like you're trying to work with them to make things better.
One of the aspects of our gang unit was the suppression of gang activity, as well as the incarceration, suppression, and rehabilitation. So we were trying to save kids as well. And we did that through various means. We had a tattoo removal program. One of the things to do to go about addressing gangs is to get the tattoos off their bodies if they're willing to undergo the treatment, and it's not a pleasant one. But it cost nothing to them. They just had to convince us that they were serious about getting out of the lifestyle, and we did some serious questioning of them to make that determination. And if they did, we referred them to the University of Utah Medical Center, and they had a laser program that would zap the tattoos off their skin. We were trying to help the kids, not so much as bust them, but to help them as much as we possibly could.
Let me add some, this would be some balance to people who may listen to this. There were young men who were recruited to Job Corps in Utah, and some of them brought with them gang affiliation. But in Utah, Salt Lake City, there are already people who live there, raised as Mormons, who had their own gangs. Tell us a little bit about the skinheads and your skinhead adventure, I guess you would call it.
Oh, you read chapter 11, huh?
I did.
Yes.
I mean, it said skinhead. I'm pretty sure it was about skinheads. And like you write like you speak, and the title is not confusing. It's very clear, so I wanted to get your take on it and maybe tell the audience what you had to say.
Now, we had gangs to begin with, but the Crips and the Bloods brought a totally different element to our gang situation in Utah. They brought black gang culture with them. They more or less introduced gangster rap to the environment. They bought the crack cocaine with them. But we had gangs to begin with. And people always were amazed to say, white Mormon kids were gang members? Yes. White Mormon kids are American kids. There's nothing different about them, except they're white. They come from a conservative religious background. And they're just like everybody else in this country. So the influences that affect me as a black man or you as a white woman affect them too. So there should be any mysterious Ouija board thing going on where they're concerned. They are gang members in their own right. But they just, some of them adopted the black gang culture, and the skinheads were Mormons. They were very devout Mormons in some cases. But they believed in that racist skinhead ideology. And I had my confrontation, which I described in Chapter 11, and it actually happened that way. I used their own methodology, their own ideology, their own history against them. And you have to read it to appreciate it.
Yeah, you do have to read it to appreciate it. I will give people a clue. If they ever watch the movie 48 Hours, this is kind of like an Eddie Murphy moment, only a little bit more dangerous. Would you say?
That's a good description of it, except mine was real and Eddie's was written in a script.
Right.
You're listening to Writers' Voices and with guest host Paul Gandy and guest Ron Stallworth, author of The Gangs of Zion, A Black Cop's Crusade in Mormon Country. Before we run out of time, Ron, could you read a little bit from the book for us?
Okay. This begins on page 186. Raised in the system, gang affiliated. America, take a look at what you created. It started in the section, grew like an erection, spread like cancer. Now the country's infected. Those words, gentlemen, are lyrics to a rap song titled Gang Banging. They clearly illustrate the nature and complexity of any issue dealing with the subject of criminal street gangs. Then, like a translator, I interpreted every line I had just spat and its implications for the epidemic growth of street gangs in the United States. American society is truly engaged in a civil war where this problem is concerned. It is a war, I'm sad to say, we as a nation are losing. By the time I finished testifying, I had performed bars from 10 rap songs, some almost in their entirety, and none censored. While I was known for my ability to decipher gangster rap and correlate its lyrics to street crime, the scope of my testimony that day encompassed far more than the narrow topic of witness intimidation. After 23 years of experience on the front line and countless hours of independent study, I felt compelled to seize the opportunity to raise the broader issues in criminal justice and use the rapper's words to punctuate my perspective on how we were failing and what we should be doing instead. Becoming a hip-hop cop meant that many of the positions I had taken three decades ago not only put me in direct opposition to most in the law enforcement community, but also aligned me with some of today's demands for criminal justice reform.
Thank you.
Ron, you know, your book is written, it's quite serious, but there's an undercurrent, I do think, of humor in your book. I wouldn't say you write with a smile on your face, there's an undercurrent of, can you believe this, sort of. Particularly, I'll point to one chapter, it was titled, We Ain't Brothers. We Ain't Brothers. And could you tell us what you meant by that in that chapter?
Yeah, it was one of the first days on the job as a Colorado Springs police officer. This black kid, his name was Flip Small, Charles Flip Small. He's been dead for over 50 years now. Flip was arrested. He was one of the biggest burglars, drug users, thief, you name it, Flip was into it. He had a half-brother named Ricky Adams. Ricky was into it, too. And Flip was arrested on this particular night. He was in the city jail, and he saw me walking by his jail cell, and he said, hey, brother, come here. And I walked over towards him, and he proceeded to tell me how he had been beaten up by the cop who arrested him. He had done nothing wrong. He was innocent of the charges, and he was being wrongly accused because he was a black man. Now, I was 19 at the time. Still new to this game called law enforcement. So I went to the jailer, who was an old-time cop, friend of mine, and I asked him, I said, why did the officer manhandle him the way he said? And he asked me, he said, did you see any marks on him? I said, no, I didn't. He said, whenever we bring somebody in and we book them into jail, we take photographs of them. He said, we cover their entire body, upper, in some cases, lower, head, but everything. He said there are no marks on him because the officer did not get physical with him. And he said, you have to be very careful, Ron. He said, because you're on this side of the line, so to speak, meaning law enforcement, a lot of people out there are going to try and take advantage of you and get you to cross over to their side. You have to be very careful of that. So I went back to Flip and I said you got beat? He said, yeah. I said, where? And he said, all over. I said, show me specifically where. And he said, oh, come on, brother. You know how they do us. I said, I ain't your brother. Don't ever call me brother. A brother of mine wouldn't be in a jail cell like that. A brother of mine wouldn't be out on the streets selling dope. A brother of mine wouldn't be going out burglarizing people's houses. You ain't my brother. That's the story behind that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Ron, the way you write and what you say in the story, I wonder if what you're writing is like, can be viewed by some as a reason why or support for we need to keep these people in a certain place. We need to keep these people down. We need to discriminate against these people because look what they bring. They bring problems. They bring crime. You understand what I'm trying to say? I'm asking what your thoughts are on that because the book is talking about a crime problem, gang infiltration to Utah from California when it wasn't, from what you're saying, wasn't anywhere near as prevalent as it became. Is there anything you can speak to that? Because it does seem like this book kind of raises alarms.
Well, I hope it raises alarms, especially to the people in Utah. It should have raised alarms to them 30 years ago when I first burst on the scene and was saying this stuff. What I describe in my book is going on all across America. It's happening here in El Paso, Texas, where I'm at. I don't know where you're at, but I can assure you it's happening on your streets. Gangs are a national epidemic. They have been for 30 years. Nothing changes. The only thing that changes is the locale, the nature of the specific problem. In my case, white Mormon kids. Did this problem, was it caused by blacks? No. Blacks didn't cause the problem. Blacks contributed to the spread of the problem, but it didn't cause the problem. The Mormon population could have handled this problem very easily by dealing with it when it first appeared on the scene, like we were advised by LA cops. They told me, when you see the problem developing, that's when you need to nip it in the bud before it gets full-blown grown in your environment and you can't get rid of it. And I tried to spread the alarm. I was Paul Revere yelling, the British are coming, and nobody was listening. They were ignoring me, and ultimately it grew into such an epidemic, such a problem that you can't get it out. You can't weed it out now. It is there to stay.
Is graffiti one of the early signs?
It is the early sign. If you see graffiti, you have a gang problem. Depending on what that graffiti is saying, could be a very serious gang problem, as in warfare between two rival groups who are willing to kill one another and anyone who gets in the middle of their conflict. We tried to tell people that. They didn't want to hear it. So you drive around town. I tell the story about police chief Alex Chaleos in Price, Utah. He is adamant to this day that he had no gang problem in his city. And I know this because he was interviewed about 3 weeks ago for a segment that the local station did on me in Utah. And he is still going around doing something I always told people don't do. Don't call gang members wannabes. They either are or they are not a gang member. There is no such thing as a wannabe, a kid who's pretending to be a gang member. You're not pretending to be anything. If you say you're a Crip, I don't care what your race, ethnicity, or anything else is, you're a Crip. You say you're a Crip, you're going to live the Crip lifestyle, period. There's no wannabe to you. And Chaleos, after 30-plus years, is still walking around saying, we had wannabes, but we didn't have gang members. That's a moronic, stupid statement, and he's still an idiot to this day. You have to deal with the problem directly when it happens, but to say that it's an indictment of the black community would be wrong.
Now, Ron, you also speak out against police mistreatment of minorities and others as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, as a policeman, you know, yourself, did you get flack for standing up against police brutality?
Well, I told you I retired as a sergeant and not a higher rank. Why? Because I was pissing people off. I'm not intimidated by rank. I respect rank. I respect structure, but I'm not intimidated by it. And I'll follow rank and structure to a certain point, and then I ain't going beyond that. And that's how I lived my career, my entire 32-year career. That's how I lived from Colorado Springs to Phoenix to Cheyenne, Wyoming, to Salt Lake City, Utah. I respected the people ahead, above me in the rank structure, but I wouldn't allow them to intimidate me, especially if it was something that I knew I had the edge on them on. And where gangs were concerned, I was the voice in the state of Utah. I was the one that was awakening the community, that was telling them this is what's happening. I was telling them this is what we should do, this is what we have to do, and why we have to do it. And I wasn't going to take or allow anybody to intimidate me because they were a lieutenant or a captain, and I was just a sergeant. And in the case of Chaleos, he was a chief of police. I had no problems telling him he was an idiot. I called him a liar to his face because I caught him in a lie. He was committing fraud, trying to commit fraud against the federal government. And I told the sheriff of Salt Lake County, who had been sheriff for 11 years, I told him in a Rotary Club meeting that he was a liar because he maintained that he had no gangs in his county, the county which I worked in, lived and worked in, and called him a liar and proved it by showing the graffiti indicating his gang activity right here in your county. Anybody who says there isn't should not be believed.
So, Ron, when you wrote Black Klansman, how did you find your publisher?
My publisher found me, actually. I wrote Black Klansman in 2013, 2014, and a cop friend of mine from Santa Ana, he's a retired sergeant with the Santa Ana Police Department, he had a private little book business going on, publishing business for police officers and firemen. And I had told him my story of joining the Klan, making a fool out of white supremacists. And when he stopped laughing, he said, "You write that up." And he said, "I'll publish it." I said, "Okay." So when I went back to Utah, I sat down, I wrote it up. 9 months later, I called him up and said, "I wrote it. I have it finished. You want to read it?" He said, "Send it to me." I sent it to him. He read it. He said, "We're going to publish it in about a month or whatever." And he did. And that got the ball rolling. Spike came into the picture about 2 years later. The book got into Jordan Peele's hands. Jordan Peele called Spike up and said he wanted Spike to direct this movie, by this story. Spike said, "What's the story about?" And Spike always told people it took 6 words for Jordan to convince him to take the story. Those 6 words were, "Black men infiltrate Ku Klux Klan." And when Jordan told Spike that, Spike said, "I'm in." And that's how Spike got involved.
Wow.
So we found the publisher, the major publisher, that took the book to a different level. And that's how it ultimately became a New York Times bestseller.
So did that happen after the movie?
That actually happened about a week or two before the movie came out.
Okay.
That's when I was told it was a bestseller.
And do you think there'll be another movie of this second book?
I can tell you that we're in discussions with some people, but I can't tell you who.
Okay, fair enough. What's it like seeing somebody portray you on the big screen?
Universal Studios flew my wife and me to L.A. About a week before the movie debuted on the East Coast. They said, "If we're going to have you promoting the movie, we should possibly let you see it." They flew my wife and I to Universal Studios, took us to the back lot, to about a 200-seat studio screen amphitheater. And we sat down with my manager, my first publisher, his nephew, and one or two other people. And I saw Black Klansman without, it hadn't been edited yet to include the music. But I saw it for the first time, and I can honestly say that there were times when I sat there with tears in my eyes, because I realized that every time they said the word Stallworth or Ron, they were referring to me. That was my name, my image in the form of John David Washington on the big screen portraying a chapter in my life. My mother has been deceased now since 1982, but I sat there thinking about my mom and how she would be crying if she saw that her third-born child had a movie about him, and it was very touching, very moving. I've seen the movie now almost 100 times over the years, and I still brings the tear to my eye, lump in my throat.
Wow.
Fast forward to 2024. Just a quick question. Fast forward to 2024 in Utah. Are you in touch with what's happening there? Can you give us an update?
Gangs are still a problem. They still, the gang unit that I got started in 1989 is still in existence under a different name. It's called the Metro Gang Unit. When I was there, it was called the Salt Lake Area Gang Project. But it still is in existence. And they're still waging war against gang members of the streets of Salt Lake City and other surrounding communities.
But your prescription is, when you see this issue, attack it right away.
Attack it vigorously, aggressively, and don't take no for an answer, especially if it comes from somebody in a position of power and authority. Tell them to step back, step off, get out of your way, and barrel through them if you have to. But don't take no for an answer.
Well, thank you, Ron, for being with us today. We're out of time. We always close with a quote, and I chose one. I hope I pronounced the name correctly. You can correct me if I'm wrong. From W.E.B. Du Bois. The return from your work must be the satisfaction which that work brings you and the world's need of that work. With this, life is heaven, or as near heaven as you can get.
Very true.
Yeah.
Very true.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Ron Stallworth, Paul Gandy. See you all next week on Writers' Voices.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Ron.